At the United Nations COP28 climate conference in Dubai, the United States committed to tripling the use of renewable energy by 2030. The time for action is now.
There is no better time than now to be hopeful about our ability to achieve the 100% renewables in the near future. We just need to continue. We've created a momentum. Now we need to keep the momentum.
If we were going to think about the grid, if we were a human body, we're effectively all the arteries, the lifeblood of that body. People don't think about the grid until it's not there.
Hello, welcome back to episode 2. I'm Dr. Carolyn Kassan.
And I am environmental scientist and activist Laura Young.
And this is the Clean Energy Revolution podcast, a series that explores the clean energy policy, innovation, and technology that's making a real difference.
This is your resource for understanding how our lives will be transformed as the world decarbonizes and how we can all get involved. So welcome to class and let's begin.
Excellent. Well, you know, Laura, I do love to teach, so this is a very good space for me. So this year we'll achieve a significant milestone on the path to net zero. The IEA, their electricity market report, predicts that renewable energy will make up more than a third of the world's supply of power in 2024. I mean, it's quite fantastic.
I know. And in the opposite direction to that massive amount, electricity generation from fossil fuels is down. It's down 4 times in the last 6 years. And we are seeing for the first time that fossil fuel electricity supply is falling, even though we are seeing a demand for electricity.
Going back to our first episode, right? In our first episode, we talked about COP28 and one of the big pledges to come out of COP28.
It just sets in stone what every country knows needs to happen. But to have that, not just from one country or one nation, but to have that globally, that commitment, I think is really important. And, you know, as we've discussed, you know, we're on that trajectory already, but it just really helps to put that in place. And these policies, you know, these global agreements are what really advances the innovation, the industry, the finance. And so absolutely crucial. And of course, it then meant that the next 2 weeks of negotiations, they went quite well, at least on the platform of that decision. So that was a really positive to come out.
Excellent. So the teacher in me now is going to sort of share a couple of sort of big numbers, but very significant for understanding sort of where we're at and where we need to go. So the renewable energy capacity in 2023 was up 50% over 2022. So in this episode, we're going to get into the drivers. We're going to talk about sort of what's happening in the United States and in the UK. I think also it's really important because I think geopolitics does play an important part of this whole story is to also look at what's happening in China. And China has rolled out more solar in 2023 than the entire world in 2022. So I think China, both for what it's doing in terms of solar deployment, as well as transmission deployment is an interesting part of that story in terms of how the world triples its renewable energy capacity.
Yeah, and it's encouraging and also a bit exciting because we know that globally, countries get a bit competitive, okay? So when they see other countries rolling out these kind of initiatives, you know, it means that progress is not only being made, but it's being encouraged. But we do know there is obviously a far way to go when we are talking about things like net zero or moving to that golden 100% renewable energy target.
Well, I can say that in the part of the Inflation Reduction Act was kind of very sort of implicitly to outcompete with China on a lot of what they're doing in renewable energy. So let's look at what we're going to be doing today. So today we're going to be sort of looking at how we got to this point, right? We're here now at a third of our energy is coming from renewable sources. We're going to be looking at the policy and the financing hurdles we need to overcome to get there, which are not, none of this is going to be easy. But I think Laura and I, we share the idea that this is doable. So we'll have a chance to take a deeper dive in today's episode.
I know, and luckily today we are not just ourselves, but we have two fantastic guests that are joining with us. We have the VP of Capital Delivery, Project Management and Construction at National Grid, Rehana Irani Famili. Hello, welcome to the show. Rehana works across project delivery and management, so welcome to the podcast. But we also are joined by Sarah Habib, the head of future price controls, also at the National Grid. Hello to you both.
Hi, Laura. Nice to be speaking to you.
Yeah, echoing Laura, we're just delighted to have you joining us today. So I'm going to jump right in. Can you kind of tell us, like, how did we get here? I mean, I think it's kind of a story of we've come a long way and we have a long way to go. So, you know, help us understand how we got here. And then when we're thinking about, like, what are the drivers? And I, because we'll come back to whether or not some of those drivers will also get us to the next place where we need to go.
So in terms of how we've got here, I think a lot of it's been obviously innovation, that beginning of the S-curve, you know, started with kind of concept projects. But the really interesting part for me is where we go from here and the drivers, as you say, Carolyn. So the drivers have largely been around net zero, around global warming and the environment, and some very strong government drivers now as well. So we have some really strong targets to decarbonize our electricity system by 2035. But that's often sometimes been a tension point with things like affordability, which matter a lot to, you know, to the public, to people in their homes, to businesses, and also sometimes a tension point around energy security. We talk about the energy trilemma. That's maybe meant that it's quite hard to progress at the rate that you want to, but all of a sudden, those tension points actually have really converged. So, yep, real hard government targets to get to 2035, but we're now seeing that actually that move to renewable generation is starting to really fundamentally support not only energy security, given the kind of recent geopolitical instability, and we've seen what that's done to effectively energy security and people's energy prices, but exactly that point as well, affordability too. So really seeing that kind of collapse of that energy trilemma, really supporting the drive to connecting more renewable generation.
You know, Sarah, I think that's a great point, because one of the things we love about this podcast is the hosts, myself and Carolyn, are not in the same place. We're not in the same country. So we can have a bit more of a global perspective. But when you mention the governments, you are, of course, based in the UK. And so it's great to have that perspective. But I know, Rehana, you are in the States. And so we'd love to know, yeah, kind of your understanding of how we've got to this point of being able to say that a third of our energy now comes from renewables.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, and it's a great place to be. And as Sarah said, it started with innovation and started with the need doing something right for the future of the climate and the earth. But then it turned into actually energy security and energy cost. With the price of renewables coming down, it's not only good for the environment, it's also good for the business. And I think that fuels a different level of growth. In parallel to that, the government incentives, especially in the US with the introduction of the IRA and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, that really fueled also the deployment of renewables. We haven't seen them come into flourishing yet. It's a beginning of it, but that pace has been increasing rapidly. So I think we're in a really good place. We've got a technology that works. We've got businesses that can thrive based on that technology. And we've got policies that we're seeing across the world. COP, for example, tripling of the renewables as a commitment overall globally, that's going to continue this trend. And it's really exciting to see.
So Rehana and Zara, both of you sort of addressed that issue of the energy security, the energy trilemma, Zara, as you pointed out. And what needs to happen there?
In the UK, I almost want to take that question back to the 50s and 60s when our grid was built. So the grid that we kind of enjoy and that people enjoy in their homes today for energy security and reliability and transmission was built very much largely in the 50s, 60s, and to a certain extent in the 70s. And
They built that grid with the future in mind. You know, you want to electrify your homes, you want washing machines in your homes, all those things. We're going to have to build a super grid. And they built that super grid. But the key thing is they built it with the future in mind. It was built, you know, looking forward to growth of use of electricity, to the kind of capacity we might need. And it served us, you know, it served us as consumers until now. We've maintained incrementally added to that grid, absolutely modernized it, but it's been incremental. And we need to go through the same scale of upgrade and transformation of our transmission network. Fundamentally, different sources of generation in very different locations means a very different grid. So, you know, the increase in demand of electricity by 2030, up by 50%, huge electrification, electrical vehicles, decarbonization of our heat in our homes. So, you know, it's servicing, connecting that generation and the growth in demand, and itself needs to operate differently. So it needs to be an intelligent network. It needs to be climate adapted as well. We need a network that's also adapted for climate change too. So scale and transformation of our grid that we have not seen since the 50s and 60s, that we have not seen in our working lifetimes.
And Rehana, just, is that the same in the United States? I mean, is that a similar story?
I would say it is. And I just want to add that our current electric grid is one of the biggest and more complex machines that humans have ever built. If you think about the interconnections between cities, towns, states, between generation and between load, I agree that the people that put it in place really thought into the future, and it has served us for over 100 years. I think where we are today, if you think about the way that the grid was built, it was built for load that we knew where it was. It was in cities and towns and in industrial pockets. And it was generation that was built next to those loads to serve those loads. So you had a grid that was designed for that. Now, when we talk renewables, renewables don't necessarily go to the load. Renewables are where the sun shines, where the wind blows, where the water flows. And so it's a very different dynamic. Now you need to actually bring that generation close where the load is. In addition to that, we have industries that are switching and now talking about electrifying. So the whole transportation industry, that's a whole new industry that is now becoming reliant more and more on the electric grid and on electrification. You talk about industrial processes and electrifying some of those industrial processes. Those are very different loads that historically have relied on molecules that will now rely on electrons. So to do that, the shape of the grid needs to look very differently. The size of these highways of electrons need to look very different. All of us that have those grids now need to adapt it into this future. And it's a global, demand, and it's a global trend that we're going to see happen. So yes, definitely similar issues here in the US than you would see in the UK and probably a lot of the rest of the world. A lot more transmission, a lot more interconnection, a lot more thinking of how do we adapt the load so we don't have to build as much, and how do we incorporate technology, whether it's demand response technology or storage technology, to optimize this grid of the future.
I think there's so much packed into that. You know, it's exciting when we hear about the renewables that are expanding and the fact that we've got so much energy coming from there. And obviously we've had the COP28 commitments that sort of makes that even more, you know, solidified. And it's great to hear about the grid updates and all these innovations. But I am also a wee bit worried, because what we also have been talking about is the fact that electrification is happening with everything. And that is everything from, as you've said, industries, you know, completely switching over on a huge scale. But also, you know, personally, that's people opting for an electric car, or my boyfriend's grandparents have got electric salt and pepper shakers. Everything is going electric. And so, you know, we need lots more energy. And I guess, you know, for me, you know, asking you as the experts, you know, if we look at these current trends of both the renewables that are growing and the grid that's innovating, but also the use that is going up, how long will, you know, it take for us to get to, say, 50% renewable generation, and how long to, you know, 100%? Or, well, can I ask, is that even possible?
Well, we're committed to, in the UK, to get to a decarbonised electricity system by 2035. So I suppose it's, what's it going to take to get there by 2035 is the key question. And how do we make that happen? To exactly that context of everyone's trying to do that globally. So I think the challenge is more how we manage this massive transition, which is happening on a global stage, and we do it in the context of needing to access supply chain, and not really access supply chain. We've got to access in a way that we're creating supply chain. So we're giving real signals to the market to build factories, to create skilled workforce. We need the skilled workforce. We're going to need to innovate. You know, just things like getting access to our network to do the upgrades necessary is going to be really challenging. So we're going to have to innovate in our ways of working and create, to be honest, a supply chain and workforce to be able to do all this by 2035. And that's part of the challenge, absolutely part of the challenge. And I think we also need to recognize that we need to bring communities with us, because we love pylons, right? And we love our grid infrastructure, don't we? They're beautiful. They're things of art to us, but, like, you know, not everybody does. So how are we going to do this in a way that brings communities with us, that we're doing it once and doing it right, that we're not making that kind of multiple visit or impact on a community as we try to upgrade our grid, that we're doing it sensitively to the environment around it, that we're thinking about where we route this infrastructure and how we do it and deploy it. So there are a lot of big challenges, and I'm going to loop back around to the skills one, because I think skilled human beings, you know, supporting factories, supporting our workforce, the kind of green energy jobs that we're going to need, it's huge. I mean, that's going to be the challenge to get there, I think.
It is. And I think often we jump to that NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard, I don't want any of this. But actually what you've touched on there is that positive aspect, which is there is a whole unlocking of those skilled workforce, green jobs, green economy, that is a huge potential. And it's kind of an exciting innovation project as well to be part of this upgrade. But Rehana, you know, from the US perspective, or kind of building on that, you know, will we get to 100%? When will we get to 50%? Does the US have targets that they've set?
Yeah, so definitely the question is not, will we get to 100%? The question is, how long would it take and what does it take? I think when you talk about renewables, you talk about the variability of the renewables, because you're more and more now reliant on the weather patterns and the weather conditions and droughts and things of that nature. And so there is going to be some thought around, how do we firm that energy need, and how do we use diversity of renewables across the grid to optimize our source to get us to that 100%. You have battery storage and long duration storage that would really feed into that. So is it possible? It is possible. Are we going to be there by 2035 or 2050? I think we will make real big headways. And my goal and my team's goal and our company's goal is to make sure that we meet those timelines and deadlines. But is it going to be easy? It won't be. And Sarah brought up a lot of the kind of foundational structure that we're going to need to put in place. Our regulatory regime needs to change and needs to look at not how do we maintain and keep the reliability and affordability of the grid, but also how do you renew the grid and rebuild the grid for this future of energy system. And so our regulatory regimes need to be looked at differently, and they need to be designed differently than they are today. Then you come to the question of supply chain. Supply chain, I just don't mean transformers and wires, but also the minerals. So if you look at the whole vertical of the supply chain that is needed, from copper, from chips, from communication systems, all of that is this what is needed to make this massive global move towards renewables happen. And I think for each country, it becomes a question of energy security. It becomes the question of economic security, and hence becomes a question of social security. And with that is those jobs. So it's the manufacturing. It's not only the energy jobs, but it also everything surrounded. And do we have the right workforce? Where are the gaps that we need to build and develop? And how quickly can we do that? I think in the US, we talk for us specifically, things like line workers and power engineers and project engineers and managers. So those are there are a lot of skills, and that's just an opening of it. There are a lot of skills that we require to build, and we require to build at a volume and really fast. Is it possible? Absolutely. Does it need collaboration, regulation, policy? Absolutely. There is no better time than now, where the awareness around the issues of climate change are front and center, where policies are friendly across, I would say, majority of the world toward the move to the renewables, and there is more and more dialogue and collaboration across the world happening. There is no better time than now to be hopeful about our ability to achieve the 100% renewables in the near future. We just need to continue. We've created a momentum. Now we need to keep the momentum.
I love the positivity. I mean, I think that's just like shines through in terms of both of your answers. I know in the United States, like the three P's, it's the planning, it's the permitting, it's the paying. How do you get all three right? Where do you see the most sort of room for change in the next 5 years? You know, in the United States, I don't think we have the deployment capacity. I mean, we have the technologies, but we have a long line, like a long queue of projects, you know, waiting for the, you know, the chance to get built. So I'm curious as to how you sort of see those two coming together in terms of matching the renewable energy that is out there to be put into play, and then also matching the grid that is going to be able to sort of manage that new demand.
In the UK, we have quite a few policy areas in play, thinking about how we start to strategically kind of plan and cater for the grid that we need in the future. So we have the establishment actually of a future, a national electricity system operator, the NESO, and part of their role will be around strategic planning. So looking at central strategic network plan, and also a new concept of a strategic spatial energy plan. So actually that, what is the backbone of the network you need? Where do those main kind of sources of energy, where are they going to be spatially located? There's still the work of actually looking at individual customers and connections and marrying that up. And I think also there is a recognition that whilst we're on a trajectory to absolutely look at how do we start to get some really good strategic spatial planning around what we need the grid of the future to be, we are here and now actually entering a price control, our kind of regulatory negotiation around our business plan for between 2026 and 2031. And we submit that to the regulator in December 24. So we need to make some decisions and start some of the trajectory, you know, half of that decade effectively to 2035, or a good chunk of that decade to 2035 is happening in this price control and this next price control where we're submitting our plan to the regulator. So we need to make some key decisions, I think, already now around how we're building that grid and marry with what will be a future network design. So it's about actually making the right strategic decisions, having the right investment logic that ultimately is going to be the best for consumer value as well.
Yeah, I really liked, Carolyn, your plan, permit, paying. I think that those three P's, I've been kind of thinking on that. So on the planning side, I think we need to get bolder and not worry about, we have this term of like used and useful. And a lot of times it has us stuck because we don't know what that future load is going to look like. But right now we know it's going up, right? So on that planning, I think we need to get a little bit bolder about our predictions of what the future looks like and think not in terms of 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, think in 50 years and 100 years and what that could look like. I think I think that we have systems that already do that. Personally, do I think we need to be bolder? Yes, but I think that's underway. The issue of permitting, and I thought that it was an issue for us here in the US, and at COP28, I saw that it's a global issue, not just ours. And the issue of permitting is a complex one because that's the one that brings the community aspect in and that brings in the what benefit would the energy infrastructure have to the communities that share the burden of hosting this infrastructure and what could that look like? I think permitting goes hand in hand with that question. And so that's a more complex one that we gotta collaborate and work through with communities, with agencies, both at the federal level here for us, as well as municipal and state level, and find a better way of doing that. And I think that's right now kind of a risk. And to the paying, there is two parts of the paying, the investor confidence, which is really big, as Sarah brought up, of how do we create investor confidence so that the investment into the building of the energy infrastructure continues and the investment in the technologies that enable this transition and a resilient energy infrastructure continues, but it's also the paying of the ratepayers that would have to pay for that energy cost. And so how would we share the burden of the cost that it's going to take to build this energy infrastructure? What is the best way of doing that? What is the fair way of doing that? And the other cost to the energy transition itself, and how do we manage that? And I think we're just beginning to have those discussions here in the U.S. and it's much earlier in its maturity. But that's probably a dialogue in many, many boardrooms right now across the country.
I think that point about community is absolutely key. And I wonder if we're bold enough on this podcast to say that there should be a fourth P, you know, it's people, because people have a huge influence, you know, to put a stop to projects or to push them through. And, you know, people also are the end users of basically everything that we're talking about. And so when communities understand what's happening, why it's happening, why we need these infrastructure changes, I think that's when we can bring about that positive change and that innovation can happen quicker, because people are at the heart of all of this. It's why we have the grid, you know, to serve people and serve communities.
Sarah, to your point, I agree with you. When I talk to my students about the grid, I say it is the most extraordinary. Like, this is, like, when you start to study it, it is exquisite, right? In what, how it was built, what it provides. I mean, everyone's life is touched by it. And 10 years ago, I was moderating a panel on the utility of the future. And at the end of it, and we had someone from National Grid, and the people in the audience are like, we had no idea the grid could be so, like, such an exciting topic, right? Because people just haven't historically, they've taken the grid for granted. And once there's that sort of understanding of how it's important to all of our lives, and then thinking about, okay, how are we going to sort of support this, you know, ambitious change and the ambitious changes that we're making? So anyhow, sorry, I don't mean to.
It's absolutely right. You know, if we were going to think about the grid, if we were a human body, we're effectively all the arteries, the lifeblood of that body. And you're right, people don't think about the grid until it's not there. You know, we take it for granted until it's not there. And often when we talk about this transition to net zero, to this decarbonized electricity network, we're consumed by the exciting upgrade, the reimagination of our energy system. And we forget to mention about the incredibly critical job of keeping the lights on, the power flowing, the safe, reliable, resilient grid that everyone loves, but they don't kind of realize they love it until it's not there. And that's going to be a challenge, you know, maintaining that safety, that maintaining the assets, the network, whilst we're trying to upgrade and reimagine it at the same time is going to require different ways of working, different approaches, and regulatory frameworks and policy that allow for more flexibility in the way that we do that. And that is going to be a critical part of the transition. We also engaged with, we do big stakeholder surveys. We engage with our stakeholders, our industry partners, but also, you know, the public, the people who pay their bills, the small businesses. And the things that still matter to them most, they care about net zero, but actually the things that really sit right at the top is reliability. I want the lights on. When I switch the lights on, I want the power there. And it's short and long-term bills. So they care about, you know, they want us to think intergenerationally about how we do work, but they care about the cost of their energy and they care that it's there. And we shouldn't lose sight of that in all of this.
I'll just add another thing, Carolyn, to what you said, which goes back to Laura's earlier question. I think when you think about the new industries that are now going to rely on electricity, so if before it was my light and then my computer and my phone, now you're talking about and my car and the ambulance that I might need and the police car. And so the lens of resilience and reliability of the grid takes a whole new level of importance. So when you think about that in this new world that we're envisioning, the role that the grid plays becomes a lot more important, and the resilience of the grid becomes very critical, more critical than it is. It is really critical today, but it's even going to become more critical at the same time as we're seeing more extreme weather events, whether it's like heats or cold or storms or tornadoes, things that our current infrastructure grid will struggle with. Now imagine this future that is so much more reliant on electricity. So I think, as Sarah said, we need to solve those problems of the current grid, build a smarter, stronger, more resilient future grid at the same time as rebuilding the grid. But it's doable. I know it sounds it sounds daunting, but it's doable.
It's the great upgrade, right?
Fantastic. Well, I mean, I feel encouraged that the questions we came with, you know, there are some great innovations happening, and at the heart of those innovations we are thinking about people, communities, employment, the environment, net zero. You know, we're thinking about all of these concepts, and it feels doable. I also feel like I'm now going to walk around loving the grid. I'm going to take away that I need to appreciate it just that little bit more. But thank you for bringing, you know, these insights and giving us, you know, real examples from the UK, the US, globally, you know, as we kind of battle with this. And so we just appreciate you coming on and sharing this with the audience. And so, yeah, Rehana and Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you both so much. It was fantastic.
I just want to say one thing, and this is, I read this a while ago, and it said, the environmentalist of today is one that loves infrastructure. And there was a picture of a person hugging transmission poll. And
that's The Economist. Really, that was The Economist. Yeah, The Economist.
It was The Economist. It was Hug a Pylon. I loved it.
That's right.
Hug a Pylon.
I actually think that is exactly what is happening and needs to happen. And so those environmentalists are the next generation engineers and the line workers and that will build this future grid that will enable Mother Earth that we want for our future. So anyway.
I love that.
Just to your point, I mean, I'm sitting here at a New York University and I've seen a massive change in the number of students who are looking to work in the utility space, in the School of Engineering, who are really like deeply passionate and committed, right? Because they recognize and they are excited by, you know, what all this change entails and how they can be involved. So that to me gives me a lot of pleasure, a lot of comfort as I sort of look to what's ahead. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
To you all.
So one of the big issues to come out of COP28 was the transition away from fossil fuels. And of course, one of the sort of the top on that list is to reduce and eliminate coal. And what's really exciting is that we're going to see by 2025 that renewables are forecasted to overtake coal to become the largest source of global electricity. So we'll have to wait and see, and hopefully that does turn out. And as we discussed earlier, global renewable power capacity is now expected to grow to 7,300 gigawatts this year from until 2028. Solar PV and wind will account for 95% of this. I mean, again, the numbers are really quite astounding and exciting, of course.
It's huge. And, you know, so what is the answer to that question that was posed at COP28 just last year? How do we triple renewable generation? You know, do we just build more wind, more solar? I guess it is a little bit more complicated than that. And we've, you know, gone through all the ins and outs in this episode. But, you know, despite this unprecedented growth over the last 12 months, the world does need to go further to triple that capacity by 2030. You know, I think my, you know, real takeaway was just the boldness. You know, actually looking back, boldness and innovation was there from the origins of the grid. But that I like the part where we talked about, often we do, we think about in 1 year, in 5 years' time, in 50, but no. We need to be really stretching that and saying, actually, what does a 50-year, a 150-year vision for the grid look like? And let's not be scared to step into that. And actually, there is a skilled workforce and a soon-to-be skilled workforce. You know, all those young people, the people that are, you know, in your classes that are coming up through our education system are eager to work in the green economy, are eager to be a part of this solution. And I think, you know, having them in mind, having communities in mind and saying, let's be bold so that we can get this strategy right. I mean, I'm just encouraged by that conversation and really helps paint the picture, because when we talk about global tripling of renewable energy, it can just feel a bit big. It can just feel a bit too abstract, but actually it's great to really get into some of the meat of it and see what that means practically.
The grid, our current grid, which of course we talked about, is sort of been with us for decades, but it's actually has transitioned with us, right? So as we think about building out new transmission and building out a grid of the future, you know, I think that's really exciting to also sort of really kind of understand what our grid has done and where it's going. And to the point about workforce development, we're seeing here in the United States just a lot of attention on workforce development in the clean energy space. And here at NYU, I mean, my students now find thinking about utilities, thinking about the grid as kind of really exciting career pathways, which makes me really happy.
Well, yet again, this episode of the Clean Energy Revolution podcast has been a day at school, a day of learning. Every day is a school day. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.